In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast in Little Steven's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Joining me is Mike Durnt, a bass player in Green Day. He and Billy Joe Armstrong, they founded the band back in the late 1980s. Since then, they've issued 13 albums with a 14th, Saviors, due out next January. Their two latest singles served as a recent double coolest song in the world, and we'll take a listen to the first one now. The American Dream is Killing Me, and after that, I'll be back on the line speaking with Mike Durnt on your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage. Back with you, and I hope you are ready for our coolest conversations, because on the line with me now is Mike Durnt, best known as a bass player for Green Day. How are you, Mike?
I'm good, man. I just came off one hell of a weekend. So lots of rock and roll, three shows in 4 days, and we're about to rip the lid off this can of whoop-ass that Green Day is about to unleash on the world. I'm couldn't be happier right now.
So something about you mentioned that the shows. Well, one of these was that festival When We Were Young.
Yeah, well, we did. So we had When We Were Young was a 2-night festival for between 65 and 70,000 people in Las Vegas, and it was sort of like when I first heard it, I actually couldn't laugh. I was like, When We Were Young, really? Come on, the name was killing me. But the lineup was pretty much every band you could think of from, you know, the early 90s to the early aughts. And, of course, they kept asking. Finally, they got our attention. And we, you know, once the show got big enough, we're like, what the hell, let's do it. And, of course, and in Green Day, typical Green Day fashion, we had to go do a club show first. We came in on Wednesday. Thursday night had a club show. Friday had the day off, and then Saturday, Sunday did the big festival shows. And the club show, it was a trip for us, because it was when we did the club show, we played celebrated Dookie. You know, it's the 30-year anniversary on that one, so we celebrated it and by playing it all the way through, and then did a full set of deep cuts all over the place.
Then
the second show, we really mixed things up for the second show being the first When We Were Young show on Saturday.
Yeah.
The second song, we played American Idiot. Then we went right into Jesus Suburbia. So if you can imagine, the first, 12 minutes of the set was pretty heavy.
Wow.
And then we did what seemed like a full set after that. And then the third show, it was just, you know, unload the hips. So we had what, three separate, completely different sets, but what a blast, I got to tell you.
Yeah. Well, so you mentioned the attendance was around 65,000 for the festival. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So
each night, yeah.
When was the first time you, like, you did a, like a big festival show, like you walked out? Cause I know, you know, you guys are sort of in the van going around, and I know what that's like, but when was the first time you walked out onto a big festival?
The first time we did anything big like that was Lollapalooza. But we were opening, it was the Boredoms did half the show. And then we came on, we were in Europe opening for a band called the Totenhosen. We came back over to the US and they put us on halfway through the tour, and we didn't realize it, but Dookie was starting to just get bigger and bigger while we were gone. And we got back home, not realizing that MTV had picked it up in a heavy rotation and everything, like not realizing the impact of it, I should say.
Yeah.
And jumped on the tour. We were opening for L7. It's funny because we're going to do this. And Smashing Pumpkins was headlining back then. It was an amazing tour. You know, it had the Beastie Boys, you had Tribe Called Quest, all that stuff. That was an amazing, lineup on that show, but we were opening and everybody would rush the stage, and that was the beginning of our chaos.
Was that a mind-blowing thing? Did you think, oh my god, we've made it, I can't believe we're playing to all these people, how could it get any bigger?
I wish at the time, you know, we were so into it and we were so young, and you know, we just wanted to play for people and you know, piss, vinegar, youth, all that. Really wanted to just, I wish I had been a little more present at the time.
Yeah.
I'm sure I think I was present at the time, but you know, but it's neat because, you know, having stuck it out over the years, you know, and stayed a band and through ups and downs and, you know, lulls and huge successes and things like that. When you get to those huge successes again, you can really appreciate them more because you know to be present.
Right. Hey, you know, on the Velvet Underground's Loaded album, you know, Lou Reed does a tune, or wrote a tune, Rock and Roll. And I guess he did it later in his solo career too, but does it first with Velvet Underground. And the line in there is, her life was saved by rock and roll. And like the character, I guess, is Jenny. But really, you know, he's talking about himself. And I was reading up on your life growing up, and it certainly seems like music, rock and roll, punk, whatever you want to call it, pretty important and central to your growing up. Is that fair to say?
I think everybody needs a vessel, you know, something that can take them somewhere. You know, if it's music, or, you know, some people are devoutly religious, or some people are, you know, find sports, or they find joy in giving or in gardening, or I don't know, whatever it is, but it if it is a vessel that you can, that can take you places, both mentally, physically and emotionally, I mean, it's a beautiful thing. And I've always felt like artists, whether you're a painter or a friggin' hairstylist or musician or whatever, there are certain artists that we really need that short attention span gratification. So whether it's like one stroke of the brush or one strum of the, you know, of the guitar, we're getting to see the difference right there. And it's that's the magic of art that I love.
So my mom passed away in 2018, and like 2 weeks after that, my father revealed that I was raised with a younger brother, but there was actually an older brother that they had given up for adoption, and he had contacted my mother over the years, but she never said, they were corresponding for a while, and then one day she just stopped corresponding, and my father had wanted, you know, to meet him, but my mom was always resistant to doing that, and so she passed away. And in fact, if my father had passed away first, it's pretty clear that we never would have even known that Kevin existed.
Yeah.
And since then, we've met him, and he's a great guy. He lives in South Georgia, teaches at Georgia Southern University in Statesboro. Now, you were adopted, is that right?
Correct. Yeah, right. That's very, so I was adopted by Native American mother, Caucasian father. And then, so who knows what I was, right? But my biological, this is the craziest story. I did a search years ago before the internet was a big thing, right? It was kind of new to the internet. Or the internet was kind of new. And I did a search. I hired a PI, private investigator. That sounds more like fancy than it is. I basically hired somebody to do a search and look for my biological mom. Well, they found my biological aunt and my mom, and they, or who they believed it was, and but they had to reach out, and I just wasn't ready yet for what could come with that and everything. So ironically, 10 years later, all right, she gives me all this paperwork, one of the things I realized at that point was that my mom and my aunt both, and my grandmother both struggled with schizophrenia, and and they spent time at this place called Agnew Developmental Center in Palo Alto. Here's the irony. That's where we filmed Basket Case.
Oh, wow.
Literally. In a closed wing of an insane asylum. And even more ironic is the day we filmed it in black and white. A lot of people don't know that. And we went down there. We had to fly to L.A. to add color to it. I remember Billy had a really bad hangover, so he fell asleep behind me. And I sat there with a color professional. And I remember picking out the blue for the floor and all the different, you know, a bunch of the different little colors and let them fill in the blanks in between. But we made this in typical Green Day fashion. We created this really cheery video about, you know, singing about mental health, you know. It's, you know, I thought, wow, it was pretty intense. Anyway, long story, even longer. later on, I took that paperwork and my biological aunt's name was in the paperwork, and I found it when I was moving, and the internet was a different thing. I punched it in, and my whole family tree came up, and found out, met my sister, my biological sister, through then. She's really funny. She goes, when we started talking for a while, I said, well, I'm in a band and this and that. And she goes, really? Oh, really? I'm just thinking whatever. And I said, yeah, I'm in a band called Green Day. She goes, wait, the Green Day? I said, yeah. She goes, you guys are really good.
That's right.
I knew that we'd get on, but it's funny because I lived near her. She lived near me until like a year before I met her. She's 5 years older than me. My aunt, and my mother had lived about 2.5 blocks from a restaurant I had for 16 years. I met her two times. Once she wanted to talk, she was talking to me, but kind of like her computer had been dropped, you know. Wasn't all there. We shared a cigarette and a cup of coffee and some smiles, and I could only understand about 10% of what she was saying. And then the next time I saw her, she wanted nothing to do with me. So the light was just switched again.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff.
It is pretty crazy stuff. This brother of mine, my mom was German, and he knew that his biological mother was German. And he said, like, when he was 8 or 9, he started having, you know, he knew from the outset that he had been adopted, and he had this, I guess actually more like 11, that he started having this, all this anxiety, worried that as an 11-year-old might, you know, that what if he was related to Hitler? That's the most sort of extreme thing imaginable. And, you know, of course that's not the case.
I mentioned
that to my German relatives, and they laugh and say, of course it could not be the case because Hitler was Austrian.
But, you know,
not really understanding the
fact, you know, that he was worried about it is a good thing. I mean, if he wasn't worried about it, then he'd have something to worry about.
Yeah, he would have.
It's like, it's kind of like if I'm not scared before I go on stage, then I should probably be scared.
Right. So you meet, it kind of seems like you met like Billy Joe Armstrong when you were like in middle school, and you guys
we were in fifth grade.
Some kind of quick connection then, or was there kind of some sort of event that kind of clued you guys into this is my guy?
So Billy's after Billy graduated fourth grade, his school combined with the school I was going to in a town called Crockett, California. And we ended up in the same class, and you know, I was sort of a class clown, you know. Still
no,
am.
Really?
yeah, a little bit. And then, and he and I just, we got on really well. I love music. I always have my radio on. There's this DJ named Dr. Donald D. Rose in the Bay Area, and he would play all the rock and roll hits. You know, it's one thing I think about our generation has is that we grew up when our heroes of rock and roll were still on the radio all the time.
Yeah.
And you were hyper-focused with, if you were listening to rock and roll, there was hyper-focus on rock and roll. Or if you were on the soul station, you were hyper-focused on soul or whatever it was. But these great songs and the innovators of rock and roll were all alive. And on the, if they weren't alive, they were still being played on the radio. And it was very present in your life. And so, you know, with our first conversation, I knew he played at some, like I saw him with a guitar at school or something like that. And before we really started hanging out, and our first conversation was about songwriting, about writing like some little, I think it was some little, he was talking about some song and I was talking about, oh yeah, I was trying to write this country song or something really weird. And then, he and I just started hanging out. We were kind of goofy, goofy friends. And then I was at his house one day, and he tried to show me. I remember he tried to show me something on guitar. First time I'd held a guitar, I just didn't get it. And then I met his father one time. His dad was on the way out. He's like, "Oh, it's my friend Mike." And he goes, "Oh, hey Mike, how's it going, man?" And his dad took off. Well, Billy had played a lot of shows with his dad. You know, his dad was a truck driver and a really good jazz drummer. Uh-huh. And Billy would go play shows with him and sing. And, Billy's dad passed of esophageal cancer, during our fifth grade year. Uh-huh. And, you know, you can only imagine what that does to a family and how hard it is. And He and I were both sort of latchkey kids. My parents managed at a bar. They were almost there. If they weren't asleep in the afternoon, they were up late at night and gone, you know?
Yeah.
So when he came back to school, he took a little, there was a little bit of time there where he was gone. He came back to school. Throughout the next 6 months or so, my mom had a roommate, who played lead guitar in a band, in a bar band. And he would let me play his guitar and show me stuff, little bits here and there.
Okay.
And I remember Billy turned, I thought he turned 11 and he got Blue, his guitar, mm-hmm. and said, he was like, "Oh, check it out." Blah, blah. I stay in the night at his house. And I was like, "You know, I can play guitar now, right?" He goes, "What?" He goes, "You want to learn some songs?" I said, "Yeah." And it was the best thing in the world. As I think about it, it's the best thing in the world. It's really vivid, but I know it's a long story, but I think it's so cool. Him and his brother shared a room. And against each wall in the small room was a twin bed. So I sat on one bed, he sat on the other.
Yeah.
We figured out three songs, and the next day we sort of had a band.
Oh, and so these songs you were figuring out, these were your own compositions.
No, we figured the first song we learned was Crazy Train. Then it was, I think, Ain't Talking About Love by Van Halen and Photograph by Def Leppard.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. We were just trying to figure out some rock songs and get into it. And he was already, so what I did, I just picked up, he kind of did the Angus thing at the time because he was well advanced over me and I was doing more of the Malcolm thing,
Yeah. So, now I know you must've told this story a lot of times, but I would love if you could share it about, you're moving from guitar, you wind up on bass, and then how did you get the nickname of Dirnt?
Oh, yeah, my old friend Mark, who's a drummer, used to, he just thought I had a bunch of energy, and I was bouncing off the walls when I was a kid, and he goes, "I'm gonna call you Mike Dirnt, because you're always running around going, Dirnt, 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 Dirnt," I was like, and it just kind of stuck in a weird way. It's funny, I guess it makes sense, because there was always, when I'm playing, he always imagined too. There's these little plunky, if you listen to our records, you always hear these little notes like going, dun, 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 bouncing around like I'm the bouncing ball behind the song,
okay.
Little bits popping out here and there.
Yeah. So at some point you moved into the Armstrong's garage and you were living there.
Yeah. They had a little room on the side of the garage.
How old are you at the time? It's still
I was 15. I was 15.
Yeah.
I moved into their place. I was, cooking seafood for like 35 hours a week and going to school and all this other crap. And I eventually moved back with my mom when I was like 17 for like a year, maybe 8 months or a year or something like that. And then I was out again, and that's it. never went back. But, you know, it was, you know, your challenges become your strengths. That's all I can say. But
since forming and working full time as a band, you've had like 13 albums. The 14th, Saviors, is on the way. That's due out next year in January. The single on one of our two coolest songs in the world this week, The American Dream Is Killing Me, is going to be on it. So for this upcoming album, you worked again with producer Rob Kovala. Did I say his last name right? Is it Kovala? Rob Kovala?
Yeah, Kovala.
Okay. So, and we were talking, you also mentioned the 30th anniversary of Dookie. So you first started working with him on 1994's Dookie. You worked with him for a while until like, what, around 2012, the Uno, Dos, Tres albums.
Correct.
Why go back to Rob now? What was the motivation to go back and work with Rob again?
We produced with both Butch Vig and Butch Walker, other records, both amazing producers and great guys. But you know, this record, it just seemed like it was right in the wheelhouse of some of the best things that we've ever done with Rob, which is this, you know, the way we went about writing this record was, you know, Billy would have a demo and he'd send it to us in its infancy. And then after we got a handful of songs, like five or six songs, maybe even four or five, we would get together and get in a room and play them, just not even, you know, and just start structuring together and really digging in. And I mean, it's not, how do I put it? It wasn't like in a, it wasn't really thought out to be like, oh, let's take it back the way we used to do it. This is just how we've always done things, you know, and we get in a room and we hadn't done this specific type of writing again in a little while, mm-hmm. where it's like, you get in the room as uncomfortable as the world is, masked up if you have to, you know, over the last couple of years. And you put the work in and you get into the water right up under your nose where it's uncomfortable and, you know, but you play and things we were just naturally, I think it was that having had it taken away from us from 2020 and everything.
Yeah.
Emotionally, everything was firing on all cylinders because we weren't even really talking to each other. We're just playing even at a quieter volume and just feeling. I could feel the kick, the snare. When Trey's playing a role, I'm matching that emotionally or rhythmically, you know, whether it's a polyrhythm or a counter melody or whatever. And we were just talking through the songs and working them. And I think that when it sounds like there's a similarity for some of the best stuff we've ever done, you know, it sounds like three guys in a room jamming.
Yeah.
But it's full, and the songs were really, you know, Billy's he was really onto something, and we made a conscious decision to try and just write the best record we absolutely could, instead of, you know, we got that Hella Mega Tour off in 2021, and really didn't finish it until 2022. That was touring that was supposed to start in 2018.
Oh wow!
And so by the time we were done with that, I said, "Look, man, you know, we were talking, and it was like." The consensus was a great album is forever. A great tour is for a summer. So, I mean, great tours are important too, but man, I really wanted to try and, you know, we really wanted to put the work in. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there was trips back and forth to London for writing and for recording.
And I want to ask you about that, because you recorded at that RAK Studios in London. Had you guys worked there before?
We hadn't, you know, it was, that was at, Rack Studios, R-A-K, it's Mickey Most's old studio.
Yeah,
it's got a lot of lineage there, or a lot of history there, but it's, in an area called Marylebone, really nice area. I hope I pronounced that right. But they, you know, that they got good vibe there, man. It reminds me of, just when you go in and look for a good sounding room, just wasn't, you know, no frills, you know, the place is definitely, it wears its age on its sleeve, but in a good way. And, and the room sounded great. And I think it just, you know, and I hate to say it, but you know, the UK carries, you know, sorry, America, but the UK carries a lot of weight when it comes to feeling like you're in the heart of rock and roll, you know, because we love British Invasion. You know, we love the, you know, just so much good music has come out of the UK, period. You know,
let me ask you. So you mentioned you guys get together in the room and like four or five songs and just trying to concentrate on those first, and then subsequently making the best album you can. And I love your turn of phrase there about a tour being for a summer and an album being forever, you know, as long as people are listening to music. So were any of those tracks, those first four or five songs, did that include The American Dream Is Killing Me or Look Ma No Brain? Those came later.
Yeah, good question. It's funny because two songs were written at the very end. And we continued the writing process, you know, went back and forth to London a few times. And then we also recorded, you know, a handful of the songs we recorded at United, which is the old Ocean Way in Los Angeles, where we recorded American Idiot.
Okay.
You know, in that same room. And surprisingly, the rooms matched up. They complemented each other very well on the record. But the two songs that were written later were two that actually Rob Cavallo was really... Billy had sort of played through the both of them a little bit for Rob, and Rob was like, we have to chase these down. We have to chase these down. Rob is as ambitious as us, and sometimes we need that other voice to come in and go there. And one was The American Dream Is Killing Me, and the other one is Father to a Son. And those two songs, I think they're epic, you know, but I can't wait for people to hear the record because you have no fucking idea.
Right.
It's very exciting right now.
Well, let's concentrate on The American Dream Is Killing Me then.
Yeah.
So Rob hears some initial arrangement of the song. And he's like, hey, you know, we got to flesh this out. Was this done collaboratively? Was this something that Billy had come up with demo originally or what?
Yeah, Billy had that main riff and demo for a few years.
Yeah.
I want to say probably 3 years, but, you know, hadn't really decided to chase it down. And this is one of those ones, too, that worked really good, us getting in a room together.
Yeah.
And playing, because when we did, the structure just came to us, you know? It's like... but he had this idea in his head, it'd be really great to stop and have it go into like a little Sergeant Pepper-y sort of thing or something.
Yeah,
you know?
That is actually a very cool moment. Yeah.
Yeah. And he had that. And the minute he was describing it and me and Billy and Trey are playing it, and he's describing it and it hits and he's humming that. And I go, bam, 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 bam. We got to come right back in with that. And he's like, done. I mean, it really just kind of, as we were playing it and he's physically describing it, it all came together very well. And we're pretty quick at structuring things together because we trust each other's instincts, at least if we're all in a good state of mind, you know?
Yeah. Well, the video for that, it got you in the midst of this zombie apocalypse, you guys, or zombies. Who came up with a zombie theme?
It was actually, ironically, it was Billy that came up. He was watching zombie stuff recently or something to that degree. And he goes, man, it'd be really cool to be able to do one like that. And, I loved the idea because I think of it, you know, as a huge metaphor, really.
Yeah.
It's great. And I think, I think the guys directed the hell out of that thing, Brennan and Ryan, and they really, how can I put it? They captured the spirit of it. You know, what's the very old one? Is it Night of the Living Dead?
Right. The first.
I mean, there's a little nod to that at the very end of it too, because as you know, there's a lot of political connotations at the very end, wrapped up in the very last
shot,
quote unquote shot.
Exactly.
But I also think it's, you know, it's a great, it just happened to land here at Thanksgiving. Halloween,
right?
You know, so happened to land right now, and I think yeah, it's just And I mean, hey, who doesn't love a good zombie?
Absolutely. And you know what? I was thinking about the B-side or the other single, Look Ma, No Brains. You know, since you did a zombie video, that then there's even more. There's a thematic connection between them both, because
I hadn't thought of that.
What are zombies always hungry for?
Yeah, that makes complete sense. That's and there's your answer. There's your reason.
Well, so we're going to take a listen to Look Ma, No Brains in a moment, but let's talk about that some too. So. Like did Billy come up with the lyrics for that? Who wrote the?
Yeah. So I mean, and the lyrics are all Billy. He puts a lot of time and effort into these lyrics, and I gotta commend him. He's done such a great job on this one. To with whether it's by, you know, he's looking through, you know, a lens, you know, at the world around him, and a lot of times that lens has to look inside too, and it can be a very vulnerable place to come from, which to me is even harder to write from.
Right.
You know, who wants to be honest with all the, you know, with all the real, you know, bumps and bruises of your life.
Well, I have to say with Look Ma, No Brains, what I love about the opening line is, don't know much about history. So when he first sings that, immediately I thought of the Sam Cooke song, Wonderful World, you know, and I thought, what a great, you sort of quick kind of toss off nod to that, you know, it catches your, you think, oh, and you're like, you know where it's going, but you don't know where it's going, you know, it's great.
Yeah. I mean, and the spirit of that song, I mean, it's kind of like, look, Ma, no hands, you know, everybody, I mean, there's just, it's almost like that song speaks so great about the world we live in right now. You know, I don't know. It's funny. It's like everything's a fucking selfie moment, you know, you know, it's like, hey, watch this, you know?
Yeah. And then he falls off the cliff, you know?
Yeah. You know,
what,
I mean,
what is the thing about, why is it so cool to be stupid? You know what I mean?
Maybe it's the Andy Warhol thing, man. Maybe, yeah. You know, everybody gets 15 minutes, you know, in the future. We're in the future now. So I don't know. It's interesting. It must be just dopamine or something. You know what I mean? Or something feeds us. I mean, there's a reason I was a class clown as a kid. I acted like a, you know, When I was a kid, it was funny because I always thought the girls would be really sneaky and they'd sneak off and have a sleepover somewhere and this and that when I was, you're like 14 years old or something. And the boys typically would be like, I bet you I can hit that window with this rock. There's no rhyme or reason to it. There's like, you know, when I was a kid, it's like, I think about where I'm at now.
Yeah.
And I think about how absolutely fucking stupid I was as a kid. And it that doesn't breed hope for humanity. Nothing would.
Hey, so it's funny the idea of girls sneaking off for the slumber party, and the, you know, you're standing there sitting there going, hey, I bet I could clobber this that window with this rock. So my daughter, so I was a single dad, and my daughter, I know women more. Mature faster, but she was like six, right? And this is the evening, and she's in the bath, and she's bathing her, and she just has this whole, she's having this little meltdown, and was really just like, I don't know what to do, right? And trying to comfort her, and the root of the matter was that her best friend is Isabel, and what if Isabel doesn't like her tomorrow? And Isabel hadn't done anything, given any indication, but this was just this little anxiety that came out, and so we tried to do with that as best as I could and reassure and things like that. And then she goes on, put her on the bed. And later I thought, wow, you know what? At six, you know, my brother and I, we would literally beat our head against a wall to see when would it start hurting?
You know,
like beat your head. Does it hurt yet? No. Do it again. Does it hurt yet? Not really. Do it again. You know, just.
That's a lot of emotional intensity. Wow. That's really, but you know, it just, again, kids, man, you know, and people, you know, that we all ride, you know, we all have different, depths to our ability to feel things, I think. And some of it's nature, some of it's nurture, right? I think. Right. I do believe that, one person's, how do you put it? I saw this thing a while back, and it's like, I think it was the Free Solo, the documentary. Okay. And they talk about how people that do base jumping and free rock climbing and stuff like that, it takes them a lot more to get the excitement it would take somebody else,
Okay.
It might take them jumping out of an airplane. It takes us doing a trick and doing an ollie on a skateboard. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's different levels. And I think that parallels a lot of different emotions for people, whether it's, things that are going to make you cry or laugh or angry or whatever. So, the human spirit's a complicated thing.
Well, now let me ask you this. So you are a dad, right? You've got,
Oh yeah, I have 13, 15 and 27.
Okay. And so the 13 and 15 year olds are dealing with teen stuff there.
Yeah. So the way I put it, I said, I'm dealing with eyeliner and lip balm and cologne and dumbbells.
So when you think about yourself back at that, those ages and sort of the things you had to deal with, I mean, how does that perspective help you in parenting and kind of trying to get inside the head of what your kids are dealing with?
Well, it's interesting. It's not necessarily easy. It's like wisdom is the one thing for like my eldest daughter. The only reason we probably talk at all is because wisdom is the connector. She's already smarter than me. She's graduated college and everything. The younger ones, it's like with my son, I see a lot of similarities, but he's also at his age, scholastically, he's a lot smarter than me, but I was also a lot more independent at his age. I mean, he's 15. I was moving out.
Yeah,
he wouldn't know where to go with moving out. Yeah. But, it's interesting. I look to them for certain things too. It's like, I remember telling them, we came back from the shows this weekend and I was talking to him. I said, I really wanted to play great this weekend. You know who I really wanted to impress? He goes, who's that? I said, you, and he kind of looked at me and I said, yeah, I said, I just want you to think of, look, I said, my ego wants my son to think I got some gas in the tank still. He goes, oh, I know you do, Dad. Gave me a hug.
That's pretty sweet. It's funny. My daughter, this is a thing too, that I always think is interesting. So people that don't have kids, seem to be very, or at least the ones many that I've run into seem to be filled with advice on how I should run my, kid,
Oh yeah.
But and one thing they forget is they let's say when my daughter was going through teen years and there was a gal I'd gone out with a couple of times and she was all about, she's probably sneaking out and doing this and that. And it's like, no, actually she's not. She's not like, oh, you don't really know. It's like, well, actually, I know the windows are pretty damn fucking high, and there's no way she's going to be.
Yeah,
it's just you're going to break a leg. But the thing was, this woman herself, that was what she did at that age, and it's correct. Like when you're having kids, and they are not you, and you may have experiences. You have experiences, and you can try and apply that, but it has to be tempered with the fact that this person is not a mini you.
Yeah, it is their life, and my oldest daughter, when I was telling her, she. Years and years ago, she used to listen to these screamo metal bands, and I was like, oh, you know where this comes from, and this comes from, and she turns to me, and she goes, yeah, Dad, she goes, but these are my bands. I can go see them live, and, like, they're part of my experience, and I thought that was a really astute point, and so, these, and by the way, if my kids, I think about some of the shit that I did as a kid, and the only reason I did the stuff that I did is because I was completely unattended. My kids, I expect them to do dumb shit. You're gonna, but I signed on for the ride. I didn't sign on for a perfect kid. You want perfection. Yeah. Stay single and judge yourself.
Well, Mike, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me on our Coolest Conversations.
Yeah. I mean, thanks for, you know, the support with the record. I am excited for everybody to hear the rest of the record. You know, but it's just so good to have some music out right now. And, you know, I love you guys' station. I love rock and roll, and it's going to be a fun ride.
Absolutely. Well, we'll just have to talk again when the album comes out. That's just what we're going to have to do.
That's the best plan. Bam. I think you just hit it right on the head.
Right now, we're going to lend an ear to the American Dream Is Killing Me's B-side, we'll call it, the B-side, the other coolest song in the world this week, Look Ma, No Brains, from Green Day, here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Look Ma, No Brains. That's Green Day here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Green Day's bassist Mike Dirnt for chatting with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Singer-songwriter Mark Valentine, he's the lead singer in the UK band The Last Great Dreamers. He's also pursuing a solo career as well, and his latest single, Skeleton Key, is out now on Wicked Cool Records. And we're going to find out all about it next time around on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.